Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, where news meets insight and analysis and we cut through the noise. Whether you're tuning in live or catching us later, I'll bring you sharp conversations with leaders, experts and decision makers who are all shaping the world around us. No jargon, no spin, just the facts, the context and the stories that matter. Coming up on the program today, the Rand's future should the government of national unity unravel. It's being deemed an unemployment crisis. How is it possible, though, that our doctors and medical personnel are struggling to find work? We'll look at the latest figures on how much South Africans are earning and why a new Chinese entrant into the local auto market is outselling its more established competitors. It's Thursday, the 30th of January. Well, on this interest rates decision day, I want to talk a little bit about the Rand to begin the show. And there's so much of the current political and economic debate focusing on legislation like the land expropriation and NHI bills. I think there might be a bigger concern looming, and that's the current strength of the government of national unity. And here's the issue. If the GNU unravels in any way, the Rand, investor confidence and economic stability could all come crumbling down with it. I'm going to talk now to the Chief Executive Officer of Future Forex, Harry Schertzer. Welcome to you and thank you. Is the market panicking or is the GNU genuinely on shaky ground? What are you hearing?
Hi, Jeremy. Great to be on. Having chatted to you a couple of days ago and saying that I didn't think that that the GNU would split, the market seems to have a similar sentiment because back then the Rand was at 18.7 and it's dropped, or strengthened rather, to 18.5 now in light of people effectively believing that this might have been an overreaction by the market and the GNU should remain steady, particularly after the DA said they don't intend to leave.
And Harry, the Rand in itself, given all the punches and knocks it's taken over the past couple of years, I would imagine has almost got an inbuilt resilience, one, and two, a very adept radar screen to see what is happening and how to deal with it.
Absolutely. I mean, the Rand has a lot of almost undervaluation built into it for these risks. So basically, investors hate uncertainty when it comes to the Rand because they always fear the worst. And if the worst does happen, it could be very, very bad for South Africa and as a result, a bad investment for them. But what that means is that when we get positive news, like the DA coming out and saying, no, we don't intend to leave, suddenly the Rand jumps up. So it's very volatile in this regard. And that's why it can jump up over 1% on one comment by John Steenhuisen.
Even if it holds the GNU, and I absolutely agree with you, there's every likelihood that there might have been an overreaction. The reality is that policy deadlock or internal machinations can be just as damaging as a collapse. It's all about the optics.
Mm. I completely agree with you. And this isn't the last time we're going to have issues in the GNU. You have two major parties who are extremely opposed in their views. And so, of course, there's going to be times that they're going to conflict and things are not going to be resolved quickly. But as long as both parties are mature enough to discuss it over a table and discuss what needs to be done and come to a combined conclusion, I suspect the Rand will do okay and I suspect our governance will be okay. It's the second that a party does something without the consent of another party within the GNU that the wheels might come off. And that was the concern of the market when the expropriation bill was signed without the knowledge of the DA.
Notwithstanding, I'm wondering if there is a little bit of business pullback right now. Are South African businesses perhaps hesitating on spending and maybe even engaging in forex trades?
Yeah, I'd say so. There is, in general, a little bit of skepticism around the Rand and where it's going. Number one, you've got Trump in the US making it very clear that he is America first in all ways, and therefore potentially damaging the relationship with South Africa. But then you've got local issues, as we've discussed, of governance, and is there an issue with the DA and ANC being unable to agree? So yeah, there is a bit of skepticism at the moment, but I actually see that as a positive, because it means that when things come right, and I believe they will, the Rand has a lot of strength to grow into, in my view.
And we have seen instability in the past, and I'm wondering if this feels better or worse than perhaps the Zuma years, and I think I know what the answer is.
My answer would definitely be better. I think we're moving in the right direction as a country. We can see Eskom, Transnet, etc. They've made massive improvements. I mean, I think it's been almost a year straight of no load shedding. And this is something that we could only dream of 2 years ago. You know, it wasn't something we thought was possible. So if we zoom out a little bit, as you say, we're doing very well, I'd argue, as a country. These are little things which are moving us in the wrong direction slightly, but overall, it's good news, I'd say.
Having said that, though, and this is a final question, it's always important to manage risk, and you've got to hedge against any potential chaos. So in your opinion, then, how should investors be protecting themselves right now?
Well, this is essential, Jeremy. I mean, if you're lucky enough to have savings or have any form of retirement savings or anything else, it's imperative to make sure that you're diversified against the Rand. And what I mean by that is, even if you're optimistic about South Africa, you cannot hold 100% of your assets in Rand-denominated assets. So I would argue that it's imperative to send money out the country, buy euro, dollar, or pound denominated investments, and ensure that should the Rand go the wrong direction, you're protected on a global scale.
Harry Schertzer, thank you very much indeed. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Future Forex.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South African doctors are still sounding the alarm about growing unemployment and the crisis surrounding that in the medical field. Despite a dire need for healthcare services, newly qualified doctors, as we've reported extensively on this program before, are still struggling to find jobs. I want to give you another perspective today, and I'm talking to Dr. Mvuyisi Mzukwa, who's the chairperson of the South African Medical Association. Dr. Mzukwa, welcome, and thank you very much indeed. Maybe the first question is, how did we get here? With a doctor shortage in public healthcare, how is it possible that qualified doctors are unable to find work? It doesn't make sense, does it?
Hi, Jeremy. Yes, you're quite right. We are in a crisis. Our healthcare system is in a crisis. And what we see now are the manifestations of that. You can imagine 1,800 doctors who have finalized their training. They've done their community service, but post-community service, they are sitting at home, you know, and ironically, there's a dire shortage on the ground, and people are waiting for these doctors to come out and, you know, relieve those long queues and all these other backlogs. But the problem is, you know, has been there due to poor planning. You'll recall that, first of all, we had all this, the output in the universities that was increased, and some students taken to other countries, you know, for training, which was a good thing. Mm. But now it looks like there was no forward looking in terms of planning for this human resources for health. There was no strategy. So hence we are here today, where there is no money now, you know, to no funding for these posts that are still there in the healthcare system. Yet we've got these doctors that are sitting at home who are willing to work even in the rural areas.
When we talk to government, it seems to lead back to a treasury issue. And my question to you, you're obviously putting pressure on the government regarding this crisis, as it's been termed. Have you received any satisfactory direct response, either from the president or the health department?
We have had a meeting with the health minister, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi, I think 2 weeks back. And presented our frustration to him regarding these shortages and the unemployed doctors. And he told us that the challenge is that there is no funding orders, a cut in the budget, and all these austerity measures. And we were not satisfied with the response that we got from him. Hence, we then requested a meeting with Treasury. We're still awaiting the response from them in terms of the meeting with the minister and the team there. But also, we had requested to meet the president because we want to highlight the reason, the need that is there out there in the on the ground, where it's not about only about the livelihoods of doctors, it's about the lives that are being lost, due to these shortages on the ground.
Are you getting the sense after that meeting with Dr. Motsoaledi that government is now simply washing its hands of the issue?
I believe so because part of the statements or utterances from the minister was that they are not obliged, to take on these doctors once they finish their community service. But if you look at, the legislative responsibility of government, to make sure that there's a delivery of good quality healthcare services in the country, they are not meeting that responsibility. And hence, we think they are obliged to fill in the posts that are out there, that are causing so much frustration to communities and also people losing their lives. Because you can imagine, Jeremy, where in an emergency, in a hospital in the rural areas where you've got one doctor and there are many emergencies that are coming in at the same time. In the hospital, unfortunately, emergencies don't wait for each other. They come at the same time, most cases. You find that there'll be about four emergencies. What do you do as one doctor when you're dealing with such an environment?
And when you mention to the minister that people are dying as a result of this poor strategic planning and underfunding, what did he say to you?
Well, the minister keeps saying that they want to negotiate with the Treasury to increase, the budget when it comes to healthcare. But I don't think they are telling or they are looking at other contributory factors within the system. Because, Jeremy, even if Treasury were to put more money in the healthcare system, if there's no efficiency and there's a problem of corruption, as we have seen, the story about Tembisa of 3 billion, how many doctors can you get out of 3 billion, that is lost to corruption? So I'm just mentioning one hospital. So you can imagine what is happening in other parts of the country. So those are the issues that we are raising with the minister to say, even though we're looking for money, but look at your system must be efficient.
So as you wait for that meeting with the president and also feedback from the Treasury, what, Dr. Mzukwa, is the worst-case scenario in your opinion? If nothing changes, where does this crisis leave both doctors and the public health system in, say, 12 months' time?
The worst-case scenario is where you find that these shortages are impacting on the patients' lives. Where you find that one doctor is unable to save all of the emergencies that are coming in, but also the backlog that may come out of these shortages. The other problem is that there will be a dire shortage of specialists because if you lose this cohort to other countries of the world, so it means that there'll be a generational gap, to fill in the space of specialists who are retiring, some of them. But the other thing is, if we continue with this, it puts pressure on the existing healthcare workers because you will know some of them, they burn out and they go into depression. They even are killed by depression, what people normally call suicide. It means they take their lives. This is not just an imagination. This is what is happening already.
I am going to leave it there with my thanks. Dr. Mvuyisi Mzukwa, thank you very much indeed, Chairperson of the South African Medical Association. And we will put a call in to speak to the Minister of Health, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, for the first time since COVID, South Africans seeing real growth in take-home salaries in 2024. And all of that, I think, is due to a stronger business environment, obviously lower inflation, and we have seen a cut in interest rates. According to BankServe Africa's new take-home pay index, the average salary hitting 17,202 rand in December. That's an almost 12% jump from a year before. But here's my question. Is the trend going to continue? There are a lot of economic headwinds facing us in 2025. Economist Elise Kruger is with me as we break all of this down. Elise, a very warm welcome to you. So what were the biggest factors behind the strong salary growth last year?
Jeremy, yes, it's quite a heartening development that salaries have started to catch up after two dismal years, 2022 and 2023. I really think it's about a business environment that has improved notably. I mean, if you just think back about the sort of effect of load shedding in the previous year, 2023, and then the alleviation that the business environment experienced since March 2024 and onwards, that I think has been a major factor during the course of the year. And on top of that, additional factors, you know, such as the moderation in inflation, some relief on the fuel price side, and then we got the interest rate cuts towards the end of the year. So overall, I think the environment for businesses were better. We noted, you know, a further improvement in profitability of companies, and that just really give a better environment for salary increases, you know, a better ability for companies to afford better salary increases.
But the question will still remain, Elise, is this sustainable or maybe just a welcome bounce due to all of those factors? In other words, are these increases here to stay, or is it just a recovery from weak wage growth, as you mentioned, in 22 and 23?
Jeremy, I think it's a recovery on the one side, but I think it should prevail into 2025, because on the one side, it's still a catch-up. You know, you mentioned the increase in real terms for the first time since 2020. So at current levels in real terms, salaries are still lagging behind 2 years ago. So there's still some catch-up needed for salary earners just to get back the purchasing power they lost in the couple of years where salaries did not keep up with inflation. But looking forward and looking at the economic environment, we do expect better economic growth this year compared to last year. And if you look at inflation, we are, at the moment, the expectation is for another year of moderate headline CPI around 4.2%. So from that point of view, I think we could expect a nominal increase that keeps up with inflation in 2025, which will add to this better environment we started to see in 2024.
No question that the better downward inflation trajectory is to be welcomed. But in terms of the salary increases, I think you've also got to ask the question about inflation versus real play. So inflation might be easing, but are we really better off in real terms as South Africans?
Yes, I did. Indeed, I do think so in the past year. I mean, the previous 2 years, obviously, we could not say that, you know, with inflation at 6.9 and 6%, you know, it was a clear-cut situation that salary earners did not keep up. But last year, I would say, in real terms, you were better off. And I started to see that in retail sales, for instance, picking up nicely towards the end of last year, as well as on, like, passenger car sales. You know, I think a combination of low interest rates and a real wage improvement, you know, will start to make an impact on the economy via the retail spending side. So I do think there's an improvement, but as we have just, you know, said, you know, two dismal years are behind us. And, you know, that catch-up will continue to have to play out to really get you to the point where you feel that you are better off.
So, as you mentioned, companies are doing a whole lot better, but I guess the question will be, are they passing enough of those gains on to staff, or do you think there's still a cautious approach here?
Well, I think a cautious approach is perhaps still, you know, the order of the day, given that there are still a lot of headwinds, as you mentioned. But, you know, I think things like talent retention and, you know, looking at, you know, the resources you need to take your company forward should play a role in this regard. And I think we do see a wide variety of different salary increases across different sectors, for that matter, you know, so financial services and IT, you know, where skills are really needed and need to be retained, are doing better. So I think the detail will really be about what the company needs in terms of the workforce to go forward.
You mention about the sustainability of this trend in 2025, but what risks, in your opinion, could derail this positive wage trend this year?
I do think if we have a weaker than expected outcome on our growth scenario, that could be one hampering factor. And obviously, if we do see inflation suddenly rearing its head, to levels that are much higher than what we expect, that could also derail the real increase expectation that I currently have. But I would say, given the base factor on growth, I'm really confident that we will have a better year on GDP growth this year compared to last year. And on the inflation front, obviously, we need to keep an eye on the rand exchange rate and what's happening in the US in terms of tariffs and so on. But, even incorporating the latest sort of upward trend in oil prices, inflation is still, in my view and in my model, showing a very moderate outcome for the year.
Elise, let me just slip one final question in, if I can, because I think this is important. As you mentioned, salary earners are better off. There is no doubt about that. But all of this is still overshadowed by the millions of people in this country without jobs, unofficially, probably 45-47% unemployment.
That remains South Africa's number one problem, Jeremy. And, as much as we focus here at Banks of Africa at, the take-home pay and those that do have salaries to report on, the bigger picture is that we need more growth in South Africa to foster employment. And I think even the 1.7% real GDP that I've penciled in for the year is way too low for making really a meaningful difference in our employment scenario. And on top of that, one could add that we need to look at our labor policies as well to enable more job opportunity creation in South Africa.
Elise Kruger, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, a little earlier this week, Toyota South Africa on this program sounding the alarm about the growing threat of what it termed cheaper and imported cars flooding the local market. And in that respect, Jetour, a Chinese SUV brand, is really making waves. Listen to these numbers, selling over 2,000 units in just 90 days. This comes at a time when the overall new vehicle sales figures in South Africa are sluggish, running around 3.5% behind 2023 levels. So the question is, what does all of this mean, this shakeup for the local automotive industry? And can South African manufacturers actually compete? Let's talk about this in a little more detail. Nick Campbell is with us, Vice President of Jetour. Nick, a very warm welcome. So let's talk about this brand of yours and others as a disruptive force. How much of a threat do you think they are to established players like Toyota, VW and Ford in South Africa? The cat is really among the pigeons here.
I think, speaking from our brand's point of view, from Jetour, we're not just a disruptor in South Africa, we're a disruptor globally. We're a newly formed brand, been operating since 2018, obviously under a really big umbrella coming out of headquarters in China. And we believe that we just bring something a little different to the market. Now, in South Africa in particular, we've done a lot of research into what a South African consumer needs in terms of their vehicle and their mobility needs. And we brought in two models that we believe can suit those needs. And just to take the experience up and really to live by our mantra of affordable luxury. So from each touch point coming in, once you deal with us, we want that customer to feel part of a family, not just that they're buying a vehicle, and to really walk that journey with them in terms of their mobility solutions.
But don't all auto manufacturers say the same thing?
I'm sure we do. I think it is, but we try and live by it at all of our dealers that we've got, just with our philosophy that we do have. I think the main concern around what everybody's talking about is twofold. One is the pricing of the vehicles coming in, and number two is longevity of the brands. And South Africans have had the luxury for a long time of having really, really good brands dominating the market. And make no mistake, those brands have paved the way for all of us, and they've done an excellent job. We just believe that South Africans right now have the opportunity to investigate something new and have the opportunity to experience something new, and that's where we're finding ourselves being fairly competitive.
Nick, do you think these legacy players have been caught on the hop?
No, not at all. Not at all. I think any new brands that are coming in will always be slightly disruptive. I think the auto industry in South Africa is tough. I think the South African consumer at the moment is under pressure. We certainly know that it's not easy at the moment, and I think, with the evolution in technologies, certainly within the motor industry, all cars come in with a base of features at the moment. Where Chinese brands are kind of leading the way, if I can say it that, is in the pricing that we do have, and that I think really comes out of volumes coming out of the rest of the world. But in saying that, I think South African consumers now are willing to search elsewhere and come and have a look at what's out there.
Nick, pricing obviously is a key determinant, but I'm wondering if it's also a price versus quality debate. And the question has been asked, do these more affordable cars, your brand included, offer true value, or is there maybe a long-term trade-off in reliability and after-sales support?
So definitely not. I mean, it's the reason that we offer a 10-year, 1 million kilometer engine warranty. That's how much we back our product, back our engines on our vehicles. I certainly pride our brand in South Africa on after-sales service. It's something we focus on heavily. We've got a parts warehouse in Waterfall where I sit. I monitor that daily because we kind of understand that it's not just about selling the vehicle and that's it and moving on. It's about actually having that vehicle in the ecosystem for as long as possible and making sure that it complements the customer's lifestyle. Trade-off on pricing, I think there's a misconception out there. I mean, we compete in the same market. We still pay the same, the same taxes, the same duties, the same everything. There's no reprieve on that kind of thing for us. And it's just about the affordability. I don't think it's cheaper. I think it's about bringing the cars in at the right point for the South African consumer and making them more affordable.
Nick, in fairness to Toyota, they did tell me they hadn't crunched the numbers, but there is an argument about local manufacturing being at risk. In other words, the influx of imports could undermine local car production and therefore jobs.
Yeah, I wouldn't really be able to comment on that from their side. I haven't, I did. I also heard that. I'm not sure where it's coming from, but certainly in South Africa, imported cars have been there for a long time. I think local manufacturers have, got their bases set up. I unfortunately can't comment on that.
Let me ask you this then. You're making inroads into the individual market, but there's no doubt that the models that you're bringing in could conceivably start eating into corporate and government fleet contracts, which would again affect traditional South African brands. Is that happening or is that likely to happen? I'm sure that that's business that your company would be chasing.
Of course, 100%. We look at all avenues to sell the vehicles. There's different segments. Obviously, retail at the moment is my number one focus, getting vehicles on the road to the South African customer. There's also a really big fleet segment within South Africa. Rentals are also exceptionally big, and of course, government business. And we will be looking at all of those avenues. And any new player or any new brands, when we say putting things at risk, I think the industry will just adjust. I think everybody will have to adjust their business plans and make sure that there's longevity in that.
As you say, it is a very tough and a very competitive market. And thank you very much for that perspective. Nick Campbell, Vice President, Jet2er South Africa, appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that brings our program to an end for today. We are back tomorrow with another edition and another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political, and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.